Since its founding in 1973, outerwear brand Patagonia has been known for its commitment to environmental protection. Today, the California-based Certified B brand is known for using its success and scale to constantly innovate its product to find the best quality with the least impact, and for its bold environmental activism. The brand is one that many company founders on this show have said acted as a reference point for them. But how do you balance activism with being a major corporation while protecting a brand? And where is there opportunity to have impact for smaller labels? You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. This week, a conversation with Beth Thorne, the outerwear brand's environmental action director for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, to hear about the initiative she's spearheading. Right now, Beth is leading Patagonia's commitment to reach carbon neutrality by 2025 right across its business and supply chain, and the company's support for over 1,000 grassroots NGOs around the world. Beth has great experience in brand and business, but has also spent years in activism, previously working with Sea Shepherd, and most recently as the CEO of Client Earth. Here's our conversation with more on what's next for Patagonia.
The mission of Patagonia is one that I absolutely love. It says that we're in business to save our home planet. And what that means is that deep into the psychology of the organization, every single person from customer service to accounting is working for the environment. They're totally aligned behind the vision. And that is really unique in the business world, I think. My role is the Director of Environmental Action for Europe. And that has two parts. One is leading on environmental campaigning, because we take 1% of our sales and put it into supporting activists and charities on the ground, grassroots organizations, to make a real difference for nature. And then the other bit of what I do is working on the business itself and how it uses its power, both to work on its own footprint, the footprint of its suppliers, and how it influences other businesses to drive change for good. So that's basically what I do. And I guess you asked a little bit about how I got here. And I think, you know, since I was very young, I've always cared about nature and particularly the ocean. I worked on the ocean for a little while. Then I went into business and I was a marketing director for many years. But at one point, it began to hurt a little bit too much to see what was happening to the natural world. And also, you know, imagining the future of my friends' children, an unsafe future, a future full of extreme weather, food shortages, mass migration, and I couldn't bear it anymore. So I went into the third sector and worked for a number of conservation charities and legal charities fighting for the environment. And then I got an opportunity to come to work for Patagonia, which I jumped on. And it's because, well, I guess at a personal level, it brings together business and my passion for the environment. But I think more importantly, it's about being part of this extraordinarily powerful machine full of equally passionate people with some really unique assets. It has this contribution to NGOs that it makes. It's a massive £1 billion business. It has connections into grassroots. And probably even more importantly, it's a great storytelling organization. So we have the ability through our communications to change how people think. And that's a big part of the fight of what's going to drive success, because it's around changing how people think and how people act. So that's why I joined Patagonia, and I'm really, really excited to be here.
Excellent answer. And I think we'll dig into some of the messaging and campaigns that you do have ongoing and coming up as well. But I just want to dig into something you said there about the machine of the brand and the company. You know, Patagonia is, for many people, consumers and business owners, a bit of a guiding light. You know, almost 50 years it's been on this same mission of really being responsible for our planet, responsible for the environment. But you come from, you know, as you pointed out, an NGO background. You worked on the Sea Shepherd, so you come with a bit of an activist background as well. Tell me why that is important for the brand in its messaging and in its campaigns.
You have to think about how change happens. And some of it happens inside the system by changing laws, by changing how business acts. And some of it happens because people outside the system push it to change. And so it's really important to realize that you actually need both. being an activist organization is critical from a number of levels. One is that those activists are pushing for change, like I just said. And the other thing is that connecting into that activism gives your organization, I guess, two things. One is it gives you authenticity. You know, you are doing things that you are uncomfortable doing as an organization and being challenged by NGOs to do things that you don't know how to do. And that creates this tension inside the organization. And you said that we've been a guiding light for a long time. Well, I have to say it's hard on the inside to be there because you're always dealing with this tension of what's the right thing for the world and what's the right thing for the business. And because you act on it, it gives you the authenticity that makes people trust you, and then they buy into your brand and then they support your brand, and it drives innovation. And that innovation was the thing that took us to, we were the first to move into recycling, I think 1990, within the sector, 1993, we were making clothes out of plastic bottles. Now 70% of our clothes are made out of recycled material. That's the highest of anybody else in the apparel industry. We have the highest percentage of fair trade. And that has required us to do a whole load of innovative thinking. The tension that being an activist organization gives you is a strength in many ways.
I guess in many senses, the business is always looking internally, as you say, to try to find the best practices in being a leader in the sector. Recycling is a great example. Of course, we are in a time now where there is a massive focus on this, from plastic straws and waste. And of course, the fashion industry is one of the worst offenders around the world, and one that is really on the hook from consumers to make changes. And companies are doing great things, from product innovation to getting involved in campaigns. I'd just be interested to hear from you. If we're thinking about a smaller brand or a company that's trying to do the right thing, how do they get involved in campaigns? Where do they start? You know, it's one thing to be Patagonia and to be a bit of a leader, but for others who want to do the right thing but don't want to cross the line with their consumers of being too in their face, what might be best practice there?
I think there's a couple of things to consider. And one is that consumers and investors are increasingly expecting this of organizations. And I think a lot of big company executives are unaware or not enough aware of this. But you can bet that consumers, and especially younger consumers, are very much in this space and will call out people who aren't acting appropriately. And if you're a smaller organization, you know, I think the real key is collaboration. So, for instance, if you take things like fair trade, often we'll work with suppliers where we're the smallest buyer from that factory, for instance. And what we do is we find out who else is buying from that factory, and we work with them and we say, what are you doing? And we have these ideas about what we'd like to do on fair trade or carbon emissions, whatever. And we're talking to them and we work with the other buyers from that factory. So I think you can be small and leverage a lot of change. Another interesting area, you probably are aware, but we're moving heart and soul into a product line that we call Wornware, which is where we are taking secondhand goods and we're selling them on our website. We were one of the first organizations to really think about consumerism and people not buying only what they really needed. And in 2011, we did a campaign that said, don't buy this jacket. And the point of that whole campaign was only buy what you need, buy good quality materials so that it lasts forever. And if then you don't want it, recycle it. And now we're in a position where we can help people sell their products. And we're doing that in the US at the moment. And what's extraordinary is that this secondhand product market has grown 21 times faster than the overall apparel industry. So there's a huge opportunity within this area for smaller players and bigger players as well to be jumping into this market and making a real difference. Because if you sell a product, you can cut the carbon emissions of the product you sell by 70 to 80% if you're selling a recycled product. So the golden star has to be, you know, how can we get away from using any virgin material at all? So there's lots of opportunities, and I don't think you need to be big to make them work.
You know, we've talked a lot on this show about the idea of sustainability and trying to show transparency in supply chains, trying to inspire people to buy less and to buy really well-made garments, as you've talked about. But let's dig into some of the bigger campaigns that Patagonia does have ongoing and which plays into your role. Talk to me about what's on your plate and how you're trying to make a bigger change in that sense.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to do that. And what I'll do is I'll talk about two different campaigns to give you an example of the kinds of things that we do. The first is for Europe's first wild river park. And it really taps into something as an outdoor organization that we're passionate about, which is protecting wild spaces. And most of the nature in Europe has been devastated, but there are a few remaining places. And one of them is in Albania. And there's a river that runs from Greece all the way to the Adriatic Sea without any dams, nothing stopping. It's one of the few remaining free-flowing rivers in Europe. And it has over 1,000 freshwater species, some of which are, you know, within Europe, the only endemic species within Europe. And it's pricelessly beautiful, completely untouched. And we have been campaigning probably now for 5 years to stop hydropower from going in this river and others. And we're on the brink of having a national park. And we thought that we had that agreed, that the politicians had agreed it. Now it looks like they're backing away. So we are throwing everything we can. We're supporting local charities. We've made a 6-minute film about the river, the beauty of the river, how precious it is. And we have a massive campaign going on at the moment where we're targeting the European Commission, Frans Timmermans and Ursula von der Leyen, as well as Albanian politicians to try to create Vjosa National Park in Albania. And if we do, it will be extraordinary. So that's one kind of campaign we do and would love it if other people got behind that. I think the other type of one I'd like to talk about is something much, much more mainstream. And I suppose this is something that I've always felt about the environment, is that we're not really going to succeed until the needs of people are held right alongside the needs of the environment. And so the campaign that we're launching is to get people to get their power from community energy. And I know that sounds sort of odd for an outdoor organization to start getting into, but community energy is basically when a local community gets together and invests in a solar panels or wind generation, and then they power their own community with that. And the reason it matters is because if they do it, all of the profit and all of the jobs stays in the community instead of getting siphoned off to some distant huge energy company. It stays in the community, and then the community can use that money to address energy poverty, or they can use that money to build a community hall. They have a choice about what to do with that money. So it's strengthening local communities' health in a sort of economic way. But the other thing it's doing is it's hastening the adoption of renewable energy, which, of course, is critical if we're going to stop climate change. And, you know, if you think about, you know, where we need to get to as the European Union, we need to be getting over 55% of our supply coming from renewable energy. And this could be a huge driver of that. So we're launching a campaign where we've got a full feature-length documentary, about 40 minutes long, and we are driving people to national community energy federations so that then people can convert in each of their own countries. We've never done anything like this before. It's very decentralized. We're very dependent on other people and other organizations to make this work. But it's also really brave and important, because if we can make this work, if we can put power back into the community in the widest sense of word of power, then we've really shifted the dial on change.
Very well said, Beth, and I do appreciate your time. This has been very interesting.
Great. Well, my pleasure as well. Thank you so much.
Beth Thorin, Patagonia's Director of Environmental Action for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. You can learn more at patagonia.com. Now, the idea for Irish entrepreneur Jonathan Legg's company And Open didn't fall into his lap, but rather in through his letterbox. After letting his apartment on Airbnb, he started seeing his guest receiving presents from the company, which made him wonder, Was there a market for well-made gifts in a landscape once dominated by branded stress balls and cheap water bottles? In 2017, he started the Dublin-based And Open with co-founders Cara Flood and his brother Mark Legg to find out. A designer by training, Jonathan had already run a retail platform that championed the work of small makers, but sensed that there was space to connect companies with meaningful gifts on an altogether larger scale. The company's first client, Airbnb. Within a year of starting, And Open was distributing over 2,000 well-made gifts each week across 30 countries. Today, its clients include international firms such as Calm and Spotify, and it delivers more than 300,000 presents a year. Monocle's Josh Fennert caught up with And Open co-founder Jonathan Legg to discuss the journey.
We started And Open just over 4 years ago, and really it grew organically out of a previous company we had called Makers and Brothers, and an opportunity we saw where we kind of started to look into our revenue in more detail. We realized over 35% of our revenue was coming from corporate requests, and we were supporting businesses like Google and Airbnb and Pernod Ricard, and working with their marketing teams, creating exclusive product they were then gifting to their customers. But that had all kind of grown organically. So 4 years ago, we were like, how do we engage in this more proactively? To be honest, I'd say we had a very naive understanding of how we were going to go about that. But as often happens, serendipity kind of stepped into the play, and we, at this very same time, were becoming hosts on Airbnb, and we were first-time hosts, and a Spanish family were due to come and stay with us. And the day they are due to arrive, Airbnb's customer support team gave us a call to say that the family that will be checking in with you later had a very traumatic experience. The previous listing they had been stayed in had been burgled. The children were in the apartment during the burglary. They were freaked out by the situation. And could we just make sure, as hosts, to welcome them into our home and make them feel safe and show them around and just kind of take extra good care of them and be cognizant of what had happened? And furthermore, could Airbnb have permission to send a gift to our address as hosts? We said, of course, and kind of thought no more about it. And the family came, and they were wonderful, and they stayed for 2 weeks, and they learned to sail locally, and it was brilliant. But it wasn't the address we were living at, so we didn't check the posts during that time. It wasn't until they had left and we were tidying up that we realized Airbnb had seen through with that proposal, and they had sent a gift, and quite a generous gift, but it hadn't arrived with it. I guess kind of what it showed us straight away were two things. One, Airbnb were like really reaching out, genuinely cared, wanted to make good and kind of really take care of their guests. But it hadn't worked. The gift hadn't been received by the guest. Not only had it not been received, they had no idea if the guest had received it. They had no read on what they had done. I guess that showed us firsthand a different side to the gifting from a corporate perspective, and led us to a conversation with their customer support team, which got us invited into an RFI where we competed against 7 other US retailers to become Airbnb's global gifting partner. We pitched through an RFI and an RFP for over 6 months and ultimately came away with a contract to be Airbnb's global gifting partner, and have maintained that contract for 4 years now.
What an incredible story, Jonathan. So you get all of this sense of serendipity and happenstance. And the situation that you were in was that little spark that set you on a different road. How quickly did you realise that the business that you were running before, an excellent service, teaming up Irish craftsmen and great designers and selling them online and through physical shops, how soon did you realise that the new thing that you were taking on, which in some ways is an extension and we'll talk about, was going to need to step aside and the old business was going to need to change or to be folded?
We were very passionate about Makers and Brothers and what we were doing there, and the network of makers we brought about, and how we championed lots of really small local makers. But there was a limit to how large we could bring that business, and we're pretty ambitious with what we want to do. And as soon as we won that contract with Airbnb, like, we were within a year gifting over 2,000 gifts a week, distributing across, I think at first it was 30 countries. Built out a distribution network with fulfillment centers in North America, in EMEA, in APAC, in Sydney, Australia, and across China out of Shanghai. So kind of very quickly, I would say, within like 8 months, we realized this is a whole other operation. This is a whole other ballgame. And then kind of also dealing with issues around suppliers who would look at Makers and Brothers and say, there's no way this small company is doing this volume of gifting. We needed to kind of reset the business. And that's when we looked to establish And Open as a standalone business, as a standalone brand. and took the time to kind of think about what we were doing with And Open, because I think we were very cognizant that we could quite easily become an anonymous service provider to Airbnb. Like, they were growing at such a pace, and we were just like, at first I'd say we kind of really scrambled to keep up with that pace, but we did. But what was really important to us is we took the time to kind of say, like, what is And Open, and to really understand, like, what were we doing, and that it was about care, and care is a really, it's such a timeless act, and gifting in corporate culture had been kind of really dragged down into this quagmire of kind of lines in an Excel sheet, and had really lost its way. And because everybody kind of at their heart knows what gifting is about, and Christmas kind of brings that up for everyone. But when it goes into corporate culture, it loses its magic. And a big thing I think about what we're looking to do is kind of bring that joy back to gifting in that world, because we believe, like, people's decisions about what brands they work with, like they want to be employed by, or what brands they want to spend their money with, were far less rational than we might like to believe. And like, emotions play a huge part in our decision making, and gifting really plays into that. And if you take care of your customer, they're going to stay around, and they're going to spend more money with you. And if you take care of your employee, they're going to work for you and really believe in you and become an advocate for your brand. So, and gifting just helps you build those relationships. And it's like, the world is changing. Like, we live in a subscription economy where it's a hyper digital existence. It's so much harder to maintain those relationships than it used to be. And it's not that people are less loyal. Like, you can kind of tap and swipe your way across Manhattan, hopping in and out of Uber and Lyft, and you're loyal to neither brand, and their drivers are the same. And it's not that they're less loyal. It's just that the kind of the nature of how we interact with brands has changed. And that hyper digital existence means that, like, we need another touch point to build those up. And gifting really plays into becoming that touch point. It cuts through all the noise, and it can make such a huge difference.
Sure. Well, we've been thumbing the ribbons and shaking the parcels. I want to open them up, actually. I want to see what kind of presence you're generating these user experiences with. What kind of products and services are you providing?
The volume of our gifting at the moment is physical gifts, and that's items like, it depends on the business we're gifting from and kind of what their tone of voice is and where, like, but we'd very much kind of look to find best in class for our sourcing, or align the gift sourcing with the message that was going out. So, like, we've done a lot of gifting for, like, a business like Calm, the meditation and kind of mindful app. And there we were kind of sourcing all our gifts in California and as close as possible to their US headquarters, and working with local craftspeople to produce beautiful mugs. And then there was a local tea producer. So it was kind of bringing those kind of things together, like a beautiful handmade mug with beautifully crafted local infusions. So, like, that's a kind of a, like, the higher end of our gifting. But then we're also doing really great jigsaws or blankets. It really depends on what the client wants to send and what gifts we'll recommend into that context. And we're doing more and more digital gifting now as well. So we gift a lot of, like, Headspace subscriptions, particularly kind of in the depths of a pandemic, kind of mental health clearly became an issue. And a lot of our clients wanted to kind of reach out and help people with that. And we also recently added a feature, because not everybody kind of wants to receive a gift, and they like the option of being able to opt out. A lot of our clients now have the ability to kind of offer them a gift, or allow them have the value of the gift paid forward to a charity of their choice.
Well, that's an excellent idea, unless, of course, it's the kind of interaction that reveals that the gift costs £2.50. But I know that that is not the case with And Open, and, as you mentioned, your premium products connecting people to local craftsmen and services. Jonathan, I'm speaking to you from London in a very hot Studio 2 at Midori House. You're in Dublin, and I wonder, you mentioned the globalised nature of the world. I wonder how important it is for yourself as an entrepreneur and as a person to be in Dublin. Could you do what you're doing now from anywhere in the world? Or is there something about the spirit of the city, your network, maybe access to talent and people who you have in your team, that is in and of Dublin? Or could it be done from a beach in Tulum or a hotel in Toronto?
I mean, a beach in Tulum sounds good.
It does sound good, doesn't it?
I mean, there's definitely exceptional talent here, which has really helped. Like, I think the fact that so many large US tech businesses have based themselves here has kind of also brought that kind of engineering and product talent locally on our doorstep. and the creative talent. But beyond that, like, I think what's quite interesting, because I was thinking about this recently, particularly kind of as we're getting asked more and more, like, what differentiates us from our competitors, and like most of our competitors are US based. And I think when you start a business in the US, like, you've got this huge marketplace like on your doorstep, and it's so easy to get gifts across the US. Like, there's no taxes or duties issues, like logistics, it's just set up for speed and ease. But we've had to emerge out of like this tiny island on the edge of the Atlantic, and logistics are really hard to do there. So we've really had to build out a really robust, smart logistics network right from the get-go. And it really tested it at first, but now it kind of, it puts us way ahead of our competitors because they struggle to get gifts out of the US, whereas we can easily gift across the US now and across the rest of the globe. Or like, we're distributing across China, we'll be doing a whole lot of gifting across Japan during the Olympics, like across Australia for Peloton. So yeah, like, I think building a business out of this tiny island has really, it's challenging, but it sets you up to be such a robust, like, you have to think global from the very beginning. You have to be super ambitious and really, yeah, robust to kind of keep pushing through all the challenges that it lays in front of you. But I think it makes then for really strong foundations. We're really just getting started with our business, but I think it's in a really good place, having had to kind of build out of Dublin. Will always be a kind of our home and our kind of first hub, but we'll be looking to open a US office next year and move globally from there.
Watch this space. And I just want to bring the picture of the business up to date, Jonathan. We've spoken a little bit about the learnings, the beginnings, and the initial push and pull of what you wanted the business to be. Could you give us a bit of a snapshot of where you are today in terms of the countries you operate in, the volume of gifting, and maybe a sniff of what we can expect as you look over the horizon a little bit?
On average, we dispatch 6,000 gifts a week on behalf of our clients. So the volumes have got quite substantial. We're doing that out of 5 distribution hubs across North America, EMEA, down into Latin America, across the wider APAC region out of Australia, and then in China specifically out of Shanghai. We are primarily distributing physical gifts. We have, today we have 9 clients. We are on course to have about 35 clients by the end of the year. We are a profitable business, which is quite exciting to be in a profitable business. We are self-funded up to this point, though we will soon be announcing our kind of first seed round. And on the back of that seed round, we'll be looking to kind of really start to accelerate our growth, doubling the size of our team. Kind of a key piece for us is that we want to build out the AndOpen platform to be self-serve. So in the same way you can go on to Shopify and build out your own e-commerce platform, we want you to be able to go into and open and build out your gifting platform just as easily as that. And we're also kind of building out some really interesting relationships with some really interesting brands, creating a gift marketplace where you'll be able to kind of log on to and open and very easily gift flowers on a daily basis across North America, or gift cookies across the UK. So we have a lot in play, and we're pretty ambitious for what we want to do with this. And I guess the way we've been looking at it, like, it's not so much we're disrupting a sector, because I don't even feel like there's like a real gifting sector in play. I think nobody's really dug into it properly yet. I feel like we're fixing something. Like, all businesses are gifting, all different parts of their organization are gifting all the time, and they all really struggle to do it. And we are bringing forth a solution that makes it easy for them to do it. And as we work with one part of the organization, we organically seem to be helping all that organization gift, whether it's gifting the employees, the influencers, customers, advisors. Yeah, we're able to help with all of that.
Jonathan Legg there, speaking to Monocle's Josh Fennert. My thanks to both. You can learn more at andopen.co. That's all for this week. My thanks to Jack Jewers and Steph Chungu, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.